This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
We're alone. Life is only on Earth. And not for long.
That's Kirsten Dunst in the new film Melancholia. Melancholia is a very moody film, and the mood is depression. But the filmmaking is exhilarating. The film is directed by Lars von Trier, and the music he uses on the soundtrack, from Wagner's Tristan and Isolde, deepens the mood. Dunstan plays a woman getting married at her sister and brother-in-law's estate. She's expected to be happy, it's her wedding. But she's increasingly overcome by depression. And her state of mind is reflected in the cosmos. A formerly hidden planet named Melancholia is on a collision course with Earth. Her brother-in-law has a telescope that helps them watch it, but soon the planet is so close you can see it with your naked eye, like a second moon, getting larger as it approaches. Dunst won the Best Actress Award at the Cannes Film Festival this year for her performance in Melancholia. She's been in the business since she was a child. Her other films include Interview with the Vampire, the Spider-Man movies, Bring It On, and Marie Antoinette. Kirsten Dunst, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's talk about the opening shot of the movie, which is on your face. And you're looking very kind of sad and maybe disoriented. Your face almost seems uneven. Your eyes are out of focus. One almost seems higher than the other. Your lips, like your left side looks a little higher than the right side of your lips. And then leaves start falling in slow motion alongside you. And it just, that's the opening shot, and with this Wagner music behind you, it just establishes a mood immediately of melancholy. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about what it was for you, what it was like for you to do that opening shot?
Well, first of all, there are birds that were falling out of the sky.
Oh, those weren't leaves, those were birds?
Yeah, they were birds.
I missed that. That's really gloomy, isn't it?
yeah, leaves are kinder. They naturally fall. Yeah, I remember that day, and we had to do it a couple times because they slow it down. So, you know, you had to
This is only slow motion. Yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Not only did you have to worry about blinking and things like that and too much, but you had to worry about acting too. But yeah, I was in a headspace throughout the entire film. Definitely. But the work that I do before I start filming really gives me an inner life and a base for the person I'm playing. And I feel like the work I do privately for the roles that I play really gives me a confidence and gives me a base of this person where I feel like, you know, very, I could do anything and make no mistakes and that I know this person better than anyone.
So your character, Justine, is very depressed. And there's this planet that had formerly been hidden called Melancholia that's heading toward the Earth and may or may not strike the Earth and end life on Earth. And the movie seems to be saying in a way that depression is like the appropriate position to have in this world because, you know, it's reflected even in the cosmos. There's this planet named after sadness, you know, that's headed our way and going to destroy us. So people who aren't depressed just aren't in sync with the planets. They're not in sync with reality. They're not in sync with the cosmos. The cosmos is saying, be sad.
Really? I don't know. I feel like, to me, when the marriage of the Justine's depression and melancholy, it almost revitalizes her in some strange way. So I always thought of it as something, you know, really hopeful for Justine, like she came from that planet and that she's, that's her mother Earth coming to get her.
Your sister in the movie, who's played by Charlotte Gainsbourg, when she realizes that the end of Earth might be near, she panics, whereas you feel like, yeah, it's fine, you know, that's the way it's supposed to be. And you're depressed, and she's, I mean, you're kind of naturally depressed, and she's in a panic. And so, like, the movie was almost saying to me, okay, we're going to die. You have a choice. You can either be depressed or you can panic.
Right.
Be depressed and accept it or panic.
Well, Lars always, he would say to me, I think Justine has strength at the end because when you're depressed, you're numb and you're fearless to, you know, major tragedies. So you can be the one that can take care of everyone else. So I always imagine, for me, Justine getting this strength from melancholia and almost having a sage-like quality towards the end. She's not very nice to her sister, that's for sure. She's not consoling her or comforting her in any way. And there's kind of an evilness almost about Justine to me, towards her sister, but also strangely calm and kind of pulling everyone together at the same time. But I also think, don't you think there are those people out there that if the end of the world were coming, some people would panic, some people would be kind of, isn't this beautiful because we all get to be here together for this? Like, there's so many, you know, who knows how people would react to this? It's not something that, I can't even imagine.
One of the paradoxes in the movie is that your character is feeling kind of dead inside, not able to experience joy even at her own wedding. But your body is just luminous and sensual in spite of the deadness you're feeling inside. There's a scene where you're lying naked in the grass or on a rock. I forget which. It's a kind of long shot. And it's as if you were sunbathing, but bathing in the light or dark of this planet Melancholia that's heading toward Earth. But it's like a classical painting. Can you talk about how that was composed and how you and Lars von Trier talked about that and the kind of, you know, painterly image that it was supposed to look like?
Well, first of all, I knew that I was going to be naked in this movie at some point. You know, it's a Lars von Trier movie. I knew I wasn't going to get away without being naked. But I didn't know exactly how it was going to look. I was also stuck on the rock, so I had to be kind of rafted over. They were on a bridge above me. And listen, I knew our DP was great and very intuitive as well because he was always carrying the camera and would have to follow us around. And we barely knew what we were doing or where the camera was half the time. We didn't really rehearse. We just shoot it right away, the rehearsal. And so we kind of figured out where we were, and then the camera would just follow us around. So I didn't know. I knew for the shots in the beginning of the film, you know, how they looked because we'd see playback, and they were very carefully composed. But I didn't know exactly how the nudity would look. I knew that it would be beautiful. Lars, you know, was like, don't worry, darling, don't worry, darling. So I knew that I was in good hands, but I didn't know exactly how pretty it would look. So it's not a terrible way to display one's body.
Lars von Trier has a reputation for putting his leading ladies through extremes, sometimes sexual extremes. Did you have any reservations about working with him when you signed on?
I have to say, I didn't. I was so ready. You don't get to work with, you know, whether you like von Trier's movies or not, he's considered one of the, you know, great auteurs of our time. And, you know, to be able to work in one of his films to me was such an amazing opportunity. You know, I feel like he loves this reputation of being this torturer director, but I couldn't have had a more lovely experience. And I was also, you know, if he had been difficult with me, that would have been an experience as well. I would have had a month of that. But I still worked with von Trier, and I'm tough, and no one, you know, I would have just fought back. But I also don't think you can get the performances you can without being a teammate with someone, you know. I think I'd shut down if somebody would be cruel to me or anything like that. That doesn't work. That's just bad manipulation, and Lars is too intelligent for that.
You know, it's funny. One of the things Lars von Trier is famous for is co-writing the Dogma Manifesto, which is a film manifesto that creates rules that you're supposed to follow. So, you know, shooting must be done on location. Props and sets must not be brought in. The sound must never be produced apart from the images or vice versa. In other words, all the sound has to be coming from an actual source, like a radio or an iPod. The camera must be handheld. Special lighting is not acceptable. And I'm thinking, like, Melancholia violates, like, every one of those rooms. I mean, after all, it's about a planet that doesn't exist in real life, and he has to shoot this planet that doesn't exist. So he has to create lighting and effects, and and it's such a really beautiful-looking film, and a lot of that beauty is from the way, like, you are so exquisitely lit, and the way the sky is so exquisitely lit. So do you think of him as having kind of torn up the manifesto at this point?
Even though it's not following those rules, there's still a quality of that naturalness with the camera, and we have the very setup shots, but then the rest, it feels very natural to me, and the way the camera moves and just follows whoever. And it does look beautiful, though. I mean, even Lars would say, you know, this is too pretty and this is too, what am I doing? I think that he was just in a good mood and wanted to, you know, he was in a very good place when he made our film.
That's funny because it's a film about depression.
I know. Well, I'm sure it was cathartic for him to write it probably too and experience that and come out of it on the other side.
Okay, so at the Cannes Film Festival, there's a now famous press conference where you, the other actors of the film, and Lars von Trier are fielding questions from journalists at Cannes. And he starts digging himself in deeper and deeper and deeper with one of the answers. And if you don't mind, I just want to play part of his answer because you were sitting right next to him during this. And in fact, during this, we'll hear you.
Do I really have to relive this, Terry?
do you mind?
No. I mean, if it makes for good radio, sure, why not?
It does, believe me.
I know. I'm nervous. Oh, God. Okay, play it. Let's see what it sounds like.
Okay, and so this is his answer to the question, can you talk about your German roots and your interest in the Nazi aesthetic?
The only thing I can tell is that I thought I was a Jew for a long time and was very happy being a Jew. Then later on came Susanne Bier, and then suddenly I wasn't so happy about being a Jew. No, that was a joke. Sorry. But it turned out that I was not a Jew, and even if I'd been a Jew, I would be kind of a second-rate Jew, because there are kind of a hierarchy in the kind of the Jewish population. But anyway, I really wanted to be a Jew, and then I found out that I was really a Nazi, you know, because my family was German, Hartmann. Which also gave me some pleasure. So I'm kind of a.
Sir?
I what can I say? I understand Hitler. But I think he did some wrong things. Yes, absolutely. But I can see him sitting in his bunker in the end. But there will come a point at the end of this. There will come. I will. No, I'm just saying that I think I understand the man. He's not what you would call a good guy, but I understand much about him, and I sympathize with him a little bit. Yes, not. But come on, I'm not for the Second World War, and I'm not against Jews. Susanne Bier is. No, not even Susanne Bier. That was also a joke.
Okay, I think the only reaction to that is, oy vey.
Yeah, it's almost painful just to hear it.
Yeah.
Especially because, like, we're on the radio. He's a friend of mine. It's you know, he's clearly nervous. And the woman who asked him a question asked him a kind of an inappropriate question about his mother and his mother's on her deathbed. Like, basically, that's when he found out his father, who was his father, wasn't his father, and his father was somebody else.
That was the question that she asked
him, like, about his own mother and her death and finding out that his father wasn't his father. So I think in I'm not defending what he said at all, but him being a friend and someone who I care about, you know, he is very inappropriate a lot of the time. And it's part of his sense of humor. And he kind of got in a role and he was trying to be funny. And it was just completely inappropriate, obviously. And also then you have he's Danish. He doesn't speak English that well, you know, and he's trying to like make jokes. And it's just so the most inappropriate for him to do that and to say those things. But he's not anti-Semitic at all. It's just sad to see someone that you know and know so well and who's like has a family who's lovely, and we all were upset with him, and it feels awkward to hear it again, you know.
I'm sure. And I'm thinking of like what it was like for you sitting next to him. The cameras are on you. And
yeah,
him.
My visual is much better than that than the voice. I feel like it's my face just goes through every emotion possible. But yeah, I was surprised that it became such a like a YouTube thing to look up, you know?
Just one more thing. At what point did you decide that you were going to try to stop him and to advise him, just like, stop now?
Well, no one was saying anything. And I remember leaning over him. I think I said, Lars, stop, this is terrible or something. You know, there was a bunch of us up there and I was surprised that, you know, I knew because of my celebrity or whatever, I was the one that if I said anything too weird or anything like to stop him, I just was afraid to even be associated with what he was saying, and I was so embarrassed that I didn't know what to say, so I just didn't say anything. I tried to lean in to stop him, but I also didn't want to get mixed up in this conversation or him put me on the spot in some weird way, so I just sat back in pain.
Except for trying to intervene for that one moment.
Yeah, I did try to intervene, but you know, he said, you know, I have a point, whatever, I'm going to keep going.
Well, at the press conference, he was also joking about his next film was going to be a porn film, and he would get you to do revealing nude shots in it.
Yeah, forget that.
Yeah, you didn't look that comfortable during that part either.
No, because we're sitting there, it's fine if it's like with friends and he's saying this and it's funny and we're together and like everyone's laughing, but you can't say this stuff in front of a room full of press. You know, he just says what he wants to say, and you know, he went too far, and then the whole next day was dedicated to him apologizing and explaining himself, and so, yeah, I feel like I'm done talking about
Yeah,
this.
Enough with that.
Me too.
You started acting as a child. How did you get into the business? How old were you?
I was really little. I mean, I was probably 3 or 4, and I would do child modeling. At first, it was just like once in a while for fun and put money away for college, and then I tried out for a commercial for Kix cereal, and I booked that. I had fun, and I seemed very honest in what I was doing and not someone who was forced into it by their parents, and it kind of had just a natural progression.
And you had a kind of conventional junior high and high school life, even though you were working?
I did, yeah. Yeah, always I went to normal schools, and when I'd go away, I'd do my same work as the kids in school, the same work as they were doing, and then I'd just come back, you know, a month, I'd be out, and then I'd come back, and I'd still be on the same schedule as everyone else, which I think really, really helps. I wanted to have a very normal, like, I wanted to go to the football games and be a cheerleader and go to prom, and because, you know, those were the things my girlfriends were doing, and so I wanted to be a part of that, too.
Were you a cheerleader?
I was in 8th grade, yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And you later got to play one in Bring It On.
I did. I had experience.
So let's start with your breakthrough role, which was Interview with a Vampire. You were 12 when you got the part?
I think I was 11, yeah. 11 years
old.
Wow,
even younger. Okay. And in this, you play a child who was turned into a vampire and is being raised by the two vampires who turned you into one, Louis, who's played by Brad Pitt, and Lestat, who's played by Tom Cruise. And as you get older, your mind changes. Your mind grows up, but your body doesn't. So you become this, like bitter, cynical woman in a child's body, dressed like a doll or a princess with long, curly locks of hair, and you really hate how you look. And we're going to play a scene in which, you know, you really hate Lestat for having turned you into a vampire and for turning you into a doll and giving you doll gifts all the time. So in this scene, you're getting really angry, and you want to cut your hair and change how you look and all of that. So here you are in Interview with a Vampire.
Another doll? I have dozens, you realize.
I thought you could use one more.
Why always on this night?
What night? What do you mean?
You always give me a doll on the same night as the year.
Oh. I didn't realize.
This is my birthday. You dress me like a doll. You make my hair like a doll. Why?
Some of these, Claudia, are so old. Tattered. You should throw them away.
I will then.
Leave a corpse here to rot?
I wanted her! I wanted to meet her!
She's not!
Yes, I neglected to mention that in the last part of that scene, they find a woman who you've fed on,
right,
as they
yeah.
say in the biz, and they're kind of upset that you've left this corpse behind. So here you are, 11 years old, playing this it's very dark part, and you're supposed to be in the mind of somebody far older mm-hmm. than yourself. Neil Jordan was the director of this. What kind of advice and protection did he give you?
I worked very, very closely with an acting coach when I was younger, and he helped me to explain it in, like, a kid mind, you know? And I was always very, very protected on set. Like, Neil and Tom and Brad, all of them, you know, I didn't see everything that I actually was seeing in the film. They would shoot certain scenes separately, or I was so young, I understood that she was an older person in a young person's body, but I had no idea about any of those emotions. So I remember my acting teacher, like, helping me. I remember there was a scene with Brad, and it had to almost feel, yeah, like I was a woman or kind of sexual, and which, you know, he never said that to me, but he was like, okay, in this scene, like, imagine that you hid your brother's toy and he's asking you for it. And you know where it is, but you're pretending like you don't. And it kind of naturally just gives you kind of a coy face in a way. So he would help me feel these feelings in a very safe way where I could understand it in my own way.
So instead of talking about sex, he'd be talking about toys.
Yeah, obviously. Exactly. Yeah. Which, yeah, he was very careful. And also, like, even emotions, like crying or screaming and all those things, when you're a kid, that's uncomfortable to do. I don't know. I mean, yeah, you, like, cry and things like that about stuff. But to have that level of anger is very uncomfortable as a child, like a young little girl. You're not supposed to do that. And he would have me just slam a door a bunch of times, and it would make me so uncomfortable that it would evoke these feelings in me, that I could get up this anger that I wasn't familiar with or was in my system at all. So there were things he'd have me do to help.
Did your mother let you see the movie after it was made?
I feel like I saw it, and then they'd close my eyes at certain points.
Seriously?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I remember I was at the premiere, but I feel like, yeah, I would just hide my face. Like, she'd be like, okay, now you gotta hide your face.
Since you started acting when you were so young, when you were a child and you were doing commercials, was there ever a period where you thought, that's not me anymore, it's not really what I want, and you broke away from that and tried to do something completely different?
You know, I've definitely gone through phases in my life where I stopped and had to think, okay, what do I want to be doing differently? And I loved doing the Spider-Mans because it always gave me a bookmark for what was coming up every couple years. And that was very comforting to have, like, those three movies, to always know you're going back to that. And then when I didn't have that anymore, too, it kind of opened up another world for me. And yeah, I think with any job, for anyone, and going into your 20s, and people change jobs or it evolves what you want to do. And for me, acting kind of refreshed in a way for me, and I approached it differently and I thought about it differently. And I think that just comes with maturity and just getting older.
Well, Kirsten Dunst, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Kirsten Dunst stars in the new movie Melancholia. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. And you can follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air and join us on Facebook. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our reviews and interviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. WHYY's chief content officer is Christine Dempsey. I'm Terry Gross.